Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Well, plenty of us think about preparations for our own retirement and make plans for what we'll do when we're older and perhaps stop working. The trip around Australia, the little place down the coast, more time with friends or hobbies, whatever. Perhaps fewer of us make plans for dealing with the old age needs of our parents. Our ageing parents often present dilemmas for children that can split families. The needs and expectations of what will happen to ageing parents is often beyond the expectations and capacities of children to cope. Kids fight over inheritance and parents are often left lonely and in some cases impoverished. Brian Hurd is a lawyer working in the field of elder law. He's seen it all. And in his new book, Avoiding the Ageing Parent Trap, he sets out all the essential information that you need to be aware of, from aged care choices to what to do when your ageing parent unexpectedly repartners. Brian, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening, Philip. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's terrific to have you with us as well. You call your book The Ageing Parent Trap. What's the trap?
The trap is effectively what I've learned from 20 years of experience, in that Australians have two aversions. One is what I call a cultural aversion, and that's a failure to confront or plan for the future. So we have ageing parents, for example, who wait for something to happen, and we have their ageing children who watch their parents waiting for something to happen. Mm. So it's a cliche to say it, but we fail to plan. And overlaying that is another aversion, which is what I call a factual aversion. We ignore the realities of living longer, because the reality is the longer we live, the more frail we become. We call it frailty creep. It's a bit like bracket creep, Philip, when you still are working. The more you earn, the more you go up the tax brackets. The same is with aging. The longer you live, the more frail and fragile you become. And as a result, you become dependent. You become dependent on other people. So it's the combination of this failing to plan and this longevity consequence of dependency that causes many families to end up in what we call a sea change. That's a crisis change, where we enter crisis management mode and we start to flail, and families actually fail because they are not prepared for this almost inevitable event management effect.
It's probably human, isn't it, in a way, to think, well, you know, mum and dad have always been the ones in charge, capable, looking after me, etc., and that's the way it'll always be.
Yes, we like to think that our parents will never get older. They will be the same, look the same, and never change. But the reality is, if you've got parents yourself, Philip, you watch them age over the years. I have a mother who gave me the other day a picture of her wedding to my father. And I looked at that photo, and then I looked at her. And there was a major difference, Philip. The reality set in as soon as I had that comparison, that contrast in front of me. She's now in a nursing home. And that wasn't something she contemplated when she got married 70 years ago. So it's a reality that we do not confront. And because we don't confront it, I've written this book out of despair about people who don't confront it and the dysfunction and destruction of families that can lead to.
Yeah, because you're dealing, of course, with the damage and trying to pick up the pieces. Tell me about families. In your book, you make the obvious point, all families are not the same, but there are types, aren't there? What's the most common type?
Well, the most common type is not normal. In other words, a normal family is not common. We have a combination of bickering families. We have absent families. We have passive families. We have even smothering families, you know, those helicopter families who hover over their parents and come down out of the helicopter and land with their AK-47s and shoot anything that moves if anything should happen to their parent accidentally. So you can't classify them under any generic heading, but the reality is none of us are prepared for what's going to confront us with our parents. Mm. And unless you are a relatively normal family, the stress and strain and tension created by aging parents exposes all the enmities and jealousies in suppressed relationships between siblings in particular. But it also exposes parents, because aging parents are also to blame in many ways, because they have this myopic view that nothing's going to happen. Mm. You say to them, how about you need some help, Mum? And they'll say, well, I'll let you know when I need some help. And of course they never will. because they're as guilty of failing to confront as the other members of the family are. And some of this is tragic, Philip. Some of this, for example, I had a case last year involving a couple who had just retired after some 40 years of marriage and very long working careers, and they each had two aging parents. So there were four aging parents, biological parents and step-parents. And as it turned out, they were aging at different rates. Two of them had to go into aged care, and two then wanted to move in with this couple. Now, that caused a great deal of tension because, as you can imagine, the biological parent was always preferred by the natural daughter, and vice versa when it came to the husband who preferred his father to move in. So we had a clash of aspirations and a bias, as it were, between the two of them as to which parent should move in. The upshot was, the tragic upshot was, that this couple ended up divorcing. Not because they didn't love each other anymore, but because they could not agree on what should happen with their respective ageing parents.
Mm.
That's the impact it has.
You say one of the big lies is that parents will ask you for help. In other words, things will be fine, and if your parents need help, they'll ask. You say they don't.
That's exactly right. And they don't because they don't want to be a burden. They don't want to create the impression that this is just the start of the trouble. And that they don't want to distract you from your other responsibilities in life. They don't want to be a nuisance. They don't want to be a burden. So they simply live in this fantasy world where things will probably get better because they just need to take another pill. But the reality is the aging process doesn't have a pill, and they will become frail and fragile, and they will definitely need help. Hmm. And the trouble is, what do you do then? Because where are they going to live? How are they going to live? That's the big issue when they become frail and dependent. The biggest issue also with elderly parents is when they get separated by their circumstances. In other words, separated by illness, as Centrelink calls it, where one goes into residential aged care and the other one stays at home. Now, suddenly, the cost of living has doubled. They've got two homes to pay for, the aged care facility and the home where the other parent still lives. Now, that was never planned for. So the issue now is siblings are brought into the mix, and now we find siblings having to contribute financially to the support of their parents in those circumstances. And you can imagine the tension that creates where the financial circumstances of the different children are such that some can afford to and some can't. So it's, I just cannot despair enough about not planning for this, because if you did plan for it, at least you've got the ability to be educated and informed.
I'm kind of very intrigued by this idea of planning for it too. But when should you do this, and what degree of plans should you make? Clearly, I suppose if you ask any child, they'd say, "Well, yes, I know. I realise mum and dad will get old, and probably at some point need help. But you know, we'll deal with it then." They would say. I mean, what degree of planning are we talking about? In other words, I suppose the simple question is, when do you take charge as a child?
You tend to take charge if you're observing your parents, if you see them. Some children don't even see their parents. When your parents are starting to show signs of frailty, of needing help, even though they'll deny they need it, the next step is then to talk to your siblings, not to talk to your parents. Once you see these signs, it's to talk to your siblings, because there's nothing like a united front when it comes to raising the crucial issues with your parents. If all the children are on the same page and raise it with the parents, that's a very powerful collection of human beings to convince the parents that they need to confront it now. So that's the first thing to do. And you also got to suspend these jealousies I mentioned before with your fellow siblings. In other words, this is not about you, it's about your parents. So you've got to come together and ignore those concerns you have about each other and act in the interests of your parents. You need to get your parents to get advice. Now, they'll be very resistant to that because this is a very complex area of life, getting older. You know, gone are the days when we died with a home and a passbook bank account at the age of 65. This whole period of later life is very complex. And you see it interfering with the retirement plans, as you mentioned at the outset, of the baby boomers. They retire looking forward to their retirement, and then suddenly their retirement is interfered by the needs of their already well-retired parents. So the retirement becomes just a dream. It becomes supporting parents.
Mm. That's right. You make that point that that baby boomers retire in their 60s, late 60s perhaps, you know, but they've still got elderly. They've still got elderly parents. And, you know, they can't just go off on the round Australia trip or round the world trip or travelling or do what they want to do because they're locked into a whole set of other caring arrangements.
That's right. So it's not a case of sitting back and waiting for something to happen.
Right. Okay. Let's talk about some of the issues in detail. You talk about wills. This just seems commonplace, and we talk about this a lot on the program, have done over the years. Wills are terribly important. You should have one. People say, oh, it doesn't matter because if you don't have a will, it just goes to your next of kin anyway. Well, not really, does it? And wills are really important, aren't they?
They are very important. And one of the great themes of my legal practice is the consequences of doing nothing.
Mm.
People love doing nothing because it's free, it's cheap, and it doesn't require you to do anything, to do something. Mm. And the consequence of not doing a will is, as you've said, the law says what happens to your estate when you die. Now, what that law says may not be what you would want if you had, in fact, taken the trouble to do a will.
Mm.
In Queensland, for example, it says everything goes... the first $150,000 of your estate goes to your spouse if you have one. The rest of your estate is split equally between your spouse and your children. Now, what that means is your children are immediately entitled to a share of the deceased parent's estate. So it doesn't go from the deceased parent to the spouse and then to the children. It goes from the deceased parent to the spouse and the children.
And the children. Yeah, you make a point, and this is an interesting one in your book. You make this a couple of times, and we'll talk some more about the accommodation deposits that one is required to make when you enter aged care, and these are quite substantial, aren't they? I mean, they can be $300,000 or so.
Well, the maximum is $550,000.
That's right. It can be more. Yes, exactly. But you make the point that in instances where, for example, one of the children helps the parent out with that and lends them the money for the accommodation deposit, thinking, oh, well, I'll just get that back when mum dies. But when mum dies, the accommodation deposit gets paid back to her, not the child who lent it. And that may not come back to the person who lent the money. In fact, many cases doesn't. I mean, it's something that I think a lot of people probably don't think about, do they?
Well, they don't even know about it, yeah. Or even care to find out about it. And what you've just said is correct. In other words, if I give my mum $550,000 to pay for her, they call it a refundable accommodation deposit, the law says when she dies or moves out of that facility, that $550,000 that I provided will go to her estate, not back to me.
Correct. And her estate may be leaving half to the cat's home. It may be a lot of things, mightn't it?
That's right. So all I am is a creditor of her estate.
Hmm.
I'm not entitled to it otherwise except as a creditor. Now, if in reality in her will she's given her estate to other people, then I've got to pursue her estate to recover my loan.
Hmm.
Now, really, do you want to be in that situation? So the reality is these days that while children are still providing or advancing money to their parents for aged care, there are things you can do to secure the repayment of that money. For example, people are taking what's called a charge over the accommodation deposit. So it gets rather sophisticated, but it doesn't stop children advancing money who are ignorant about this law.
Mm.
And the reality is that leads to further in family implosion.
Yes, exactly. It's important to remember. That's right. Because I imagine, Brian, and well, you see it every day in your practice, that it would be relatively common, I would think, for family members to maybe have to contribute to the refundable accommodation deposit in many instances because, although it's refundable, it's steep. It's a lump sum. It has to be usually paid in one go, usually. And that it's probably common enough for you know siblings, parent for children to say, well, let's help mum and dad out here.
That's right. Now that gets complicated because again, as I said before, the ability of children to contribute depends on their own financial circumstances.
Mm.
Not to mention the attitude of the daughter-in-law or the son-in-law, who don't particularly appreciate giving away or advancing joint monies for the benefit of the mother-in-law or the father-in-law.
Mm.
So you've got that sort of little bubbling issue to the side as well. But as between the siblings, they are contributing. It is happening. Because what they want is the best for mum or dad, which means the more they can pay in that refundable accommodation deposit, the better the accommodation. So there's pressure on them to pay as much as they can, but in terms of who pays what, that becomes a tension point, because some can afford to pay more than others. So then you have to document the arrangement between them and the advancing of the money to mum in particular. And of course Australians have this, it's anathema for family members to document their arrangements, their legal arrangements. They just don't like doing it. It's a case of shake hands or nod, nod, wink, wink, trust me.
Yes, well, you make a number of points about the dangers of these informal oral arrangements, don't you?
I do, because they invariably unravel and end up in court. I've had many cases where they have.
Instances where, for example, and you, as you state in your book, I mean, you've had people in front of you in cases where one sibling, for example, has lent, well, has given money for an accommodation deposit or for some other reason to the parent, when the parent says, well, you know, obviously when I die, you'll get that back. But of course, later on, the parent or indeed other siblings might say, oh, no, that was a gift. And if there's no documentation to prove otherwise, it could get very difficult, can't it?
Extremely difficult. And the last thing a parent wants to leave on earth is a legacy of family implosion. And the best way to avoid that is to document these arrangements if you're going to enter into them. So, you know, I just bang my head against a brick wall about this because I see the consequences of not doing these things, which is tragic.
Yes. Keith on the text line, by the way. I'm talking with Brian Hurd, who's a lawyer working in the field of elder law, and he's written a very intriguing information-filled book called Avoiding the Ageing Parent Trap, which sets out a lot of the essential information you need to be aware of when planning for the aged care of your parents and what to do, particularly when your ageing parent unexpectedly falls into a situation of needing help. Keith says, thanks for the program. If it costs, say, $400,000 for a senior to get into an aged care residence, does it cost another $400,000 for the other senior parent?
That can be right, yes.
Sometimes it can cost twice, can't it?
Two people pay separate refundable accommodation deposits. So they treat you as an individual, even though you're a married couple, for the purposes of aged care. And the same applies with Centrelink. So if two people move in at the same time to aged care, that's double whammy, as they call it.
Jim,
so it's very expensive.
Yeah, Jim says when my parents went into aged care, they did have the option of paying the deposit as they went along rather than as a lump sum up front. I think that's still the case in some instances, isn't it, Jim? I mean, it's frequently demanded up front, but it can be. There are. I mean, it depends on the place, I suppose.
No, it's the resident's choice. So the resident can pay a lump sum, or they can pay what's called a DAP, a daily accommodation payment, which is effectively paying off the refundable accommodation lump sum. So they've got that choice. Or they can do a combination of both, a little bit of lump sum and a little bit of DAP, or daily accommodation payment. And this is where it gets complicated, and this is where people make the big mistake of not getting financial advice about how to pay it and what to do, for example, with the family home. That's the big issue when it comes to
why is that? Tell me about that. Why is that a big issue?
Because the family home has special rules when it comes to whether it's taken into account in assessing how much you have to pay when you go into aged care. Similarly with Centrelink, the pension rules apply in relation to your family home. The family home is normally exempt from the assets test. And similar rules can apply when it comes to them assessing how much you should pay to go into aged care. So what you do about the home, whether you keep it or sell it, can have serious consequences on the level and the extent of your aged care fees.
You make a point that selling the house, you need to think carefully about selling the house to do things like paying for the refundable accommodation deposit, for example, because that can affect, well, apart from, it may possibly generate tax in liabilities, and it also may affect Centrelink benefits and the level of the aged care pension.
That's right, because the home when you're living in it is an exempt asset. In other words, it's untouchable as Centrelink is concerned, and it's untouchable for 2 years after you move into aged care. Once you sell it, you convert it into an assessable asset called cash. So cash becomes an assessable asset, both for Centrelink purposes and for aged care purposes. So that sale issue is crucial in determining whether you should, and if so, what to do with the proceeds. Because if you use the proceeds to pay the refundable accommodation deposit, that can be very helpful in reducing aged care fees. But the reality is you have to make decisions about this. And it's not very helpful for your children to assign themselves the in-house expert to try and find out what is the best way to do it, because this is really complex. And Centrelink doesn't give you what they call the oops factor. In other words, they don't give you a second chance once you've made a decision which you subsequently realise was the wrong decision.
Hmm. Joyce asks, she says, Phil and Brian, my other half and I have been together for 16 years but not married. I've got no children. He has three. Plus he's got grandchildren in the UK. I'm 66, so he's 74. If he becomes ill, who has the final say re his healthcare? Me as the de facto partner or his children? We're both fit and well now, but who knows?
Well, the answer to that question is, and I hate saying this, lawyers say it all the time, it depends. As a consequence, the first answer is, if he has made an enduring power of attorney, in that document he could have appointed someone to make healthcare decisions if he becomes incapable. If he hasn't done an enduring power of attorney, then certainly in Queensland, the spouse, that is, you, the de facto, would be entitled to make those healthcare decisions. So the answer to Queensland is, it's either the answer is in an enduring power of attorney that he's done. If he hasn't done one, the law would say someone is deemed to be his healthcare decision maker, which would be firstly the spouse.
Right. His de facto spouse in this case.
The de facto spouse in this case.
Okay. There you go, Joyce. Can we talk about powers of attorney? You spent some time talking about them. Well, what's called enduring powers of attorney. This is essentially a legal document which empowers one family member, typically a family member, to make decisions on behalf of the parents. And that may include disposal of property, management of bank accounts, you know, signing of documents and so on. You say it's very important to have these in place, but it gets tricky when there's multiple siblings, doesn't it? What do you say here? I mean, should all the siblings have a shared power, or should one just have the power, or should maybe two with, you know, both to sign? What's the ideal arrangement?
Well, before I answer that, can I just answer the initial question of why it's so important to have one?
Mm-hmm.
It is important to have one because if you don't have one and you lose your capacity to make your own decisions, for whatever reason, nobody in the entire world can make financial decisions for you. Not your spouse, not your children, nobody. So you are then what the law calls in a black legal hole.
Mm-hmm.
It would require, for example, your spouse to go off to a tribunal in order to get appointed to make decisions for you. So not having one, this is this do-nothing problem. By not having one in place, you again assign your family to unnecessary cost, expense and legal processes in getting someone appointed. And then it becomes a real issue where you don't have a spouse, but you've got five children. And the issue becomes, which of those children are going to apply to the tribunal to be appointed? That is another point of implosion.
Mm.
So by having an enduring power of attorney in place, you can avoid all that schmozzle. But in terms of who to appoint amongst your five children, it can be a diplomatic nightmare, because the reality is if you have five children, you don't want to appoint all five of them.
Why not?
Because if it's said in the agreement that all five of them have to agree on the decision, that's impractical, isn't it? What's the odds that five children could agree each time a decision had to be made about their mum or their dad?
Well, it may be possible, but you're right. If one person's recalcitrant, then it's going to be difficult.
Extremely difficult. So you have to think about creative ways to address wanting to be inclusive, that is, include them all, but at the same time make it practical. So you could, for example, appoint two of them, but in the document say you require those two to tell the other three about the decisions they make.
Hmm.
So that's a lovely combination of both practicality. In other words, only two have to make the decision, but the other three know about the decisions.
They're quite important documents, aren't they? I mean, I know in some states, perhaps in all states, perhaps you could tell us, they're often registered, aren't they, into powers of attorney, particularly if you're dealing with property and so on. They are quite important legal documents with a lot of power attached to them, aren't they?
crucial documents to have in place, but also they can be misused. Every state and territory has an enduring power of attorney that you can you can complete. You don't have to register them in any state, but you can if you wish to, and you have to if you're going to use the document to buy and sell land or property.
Yes, so if you're going to sell the parents' house, for example.
You have to register the enduring power of attorney. So that's the law generally. But you need to be very careful, of course, in terms of who you appoint, because these documents, these enduring power of attorney documents, can be misused. Because what you're doing is bestowing all this power on someone to effectively stand in your shoes as if they were you.
What do you do if one of the siblings has the power of attorney, the enduring power of attorney, and then goes nuts and decides, well, you know, I know what's best, and I'm going to sell part of the house, and I'm going to, you know, do this and do that, and no, you can't come and see mum and dad unless I say so, and also, you know, I'm going to be paying myself an allowance out of their estate, and so, in other words, goes rogue. What do you do about that?
Well, in our practice, that's a common problem, because when children are bestowed with this power, they think they've been crowned king and queen of the family, and they have all these so-called dictatorial powers. But the reality is there's a three-step process we use. Firstly, we write to the recalcitrant person and say, these are your responsibilities. This is the law. Comply with the law, please. They don't. The next step is to go off to what's called the public guardian. Now, that's certainly the case in Queensland. They're called different things in other states and territories in our wonderful federal system. But if you go off to the public guardian is what's called the incapacity policeman. And they can investigate the sort of conduct that you're just talking about. Mm-hmm. And if the conduct is serious enough, then they can actually apply to a tribunal to have that attorney sacked. But if they decide not to, the children themselves, the other children, can apply to a tribunal to have that attorney sacked as well. Mm. So there are recourses that you can pursue where a particular child misuses or exceeds their power or decides to exclude the other siblings from all decision-making issues in order to get rid of that sibling.
I imagine not easy and not cheap to do so, though.
Not at all. Not at all. That's why it's never prudent to appoint just one child.
Yeah. Okay.
If you've got more than one child.
So let's take some calls. Helen, hello.
Oh, good evening. Look, I was in a situation with my father that I borrowed $30,000, and it was just on a handshake, and he knew that I would pay him back. Mm-hmm. He said to me, well, darling, just pay me the whole $30,000 and I'm not going to charge you any interest or anything like that. And after about 5 years after I'd paid him the $30,000, he became that much older and a bit more senile, and he said, yes, well, just count that $30,000 that you've paid me in interest, and I want the principal.
Right.
Oh, you
so he wanted it again, did he?
Well, he said, just count that as interest. I want the principal. I want my $30,000 back.
Yep. That's the downside of a handshake.
And so, you know, nothing was recorded or set into place with the lawyer, and then it caused an enormous amount of trouble with my brother.
Yes, I could imagine. And that's because it was all oral.
Yes.
And orals don't work when it comes to, particularly in your father's situation, where if he became slightly delusional, he may not have remembered anything. So you now have this. You have this situation where he doesn't remember. You do, but you've got no record or document to prove anything except what you say or what he says.
Exactly.
So that's a problem, and that's why, you know, I try to get over this problem with families of this avoidance mentality about not wanting to pieces of paper and put words on the piece of paper to record the arrangement.
Okay. Thing right, Helen. That's I suppose underlying what Brian's saying here. Deborah in Tassie. Deb, good day.
Yeah, hi, how are you?
I'm well.
That's good. My mother passed nearly a year ago, and since then I've been so keen to make a will. Now, which is a better will? Or is a will pack from the news agents just as legal as one from the public trustee?
The answer to that is, and there it is again, it depends. If you do the will from the post office correctly, then it is as valid as if you did a will with a solicitor or a public trustee. The trouble is, from my experience, that many people don't do it properly, because the law's pretty strict about how do you complete a will. And if you don't comply with those strict requirements, then you can end up in court with some dispute about the validity of the will, and that's not what you want.
Yeah.
The trouble with Australians is we concentrate too much on the price of doing something as opposed to the cost of doing nothing or not doing something well. So you could save yourself lots of money in the beginning, but cost your family lots of money at the end. Yeah. So as long as you comply with the strict requirements of doing a DIY will, that's fine, no problem. Yeah. And as long as it reflects your wishes, I've seen many mistakes made in DIY wills, which would not have happened if they were done with the assistance of some professional advisor.
Yeah, and I've read through it quite a few times. That's Justice of Peace and the registering of it.
Yep, I mean, it's the advice, I think, Deborah, is, you know, get it done professionally. It's the point you're making, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm banging on it about it, I know. But the reality is, I'm saying this from 20 years' experience. And the book is a reflection of that despair that I mentioned before.
Sure. Deb says, we've got three kids. Picking one or even two to have an enduring power of attorney would tear the family apart. Ideas, please.
Right. That sounds like a dynamite family. I don't know why you couldn't appoint all three and then say any two of them could make decisions, which is not uncommon. So again, you're including all three, but you're enabling a practical decision-making process by saying only two, a majority, need to make the decision.
In other words, appoint three, but two can sign.
Correct. Or appoint someone outside your children. That could be anybody. Could be a professional person, could be a trustee company, a friend, anybody who's prepared to take on the role. But it would be unusual not to choose your children. But then if you've got these dynamics in the family which are difficult, there are ways of overcoming those difficulties with an intelligent way of preparing and completing the document.
Okay. Don, hello.
Good evening, and thank goodness for Brian. He's brilliant, and thank goodness he's done that book. And I'd just like to make a few very quick comments. When Mum was with us at home, or with me, ACAT assessment up front and occupational therapists came through. They were great to make the house safe. Community nurses were brilliant. When the community nurses stopped calling, they were our conduit, and I didn't know, and Mum didn't know what to tap into. So you need to know what to tap into to get the help you need. And in aged care, I found random times to visit is good, because then you get a better overall picture of how they're being cared for. Love outings. And the last comment on for me is our parents, they were there for us, so we need to be there for them. We have to repay that, and your conscience is a lot better as you get on in years if you do that. So I hope that may be of some help.
Yep, thank you for that. I mean, I'm sure, Brian, you'd agree with that, would you?
I thoroughly agree with that. Can I just say another thing that might be important to understand in terms of what's happening with COVID as well, Philip? And that is the issue of where our parents are going to live when they get frail. What's happening at the moment, from my experience, is that COVID is forcing many families to turn inwards in terms of what to do about caring for mum or dad. In other words, they're preferring not to have them go into residential aged care. They can't get enough home care delivered to meet the needs of their parents. So what's happening is lots of family arrangements or granny flat agreements are being entered into. So the family starts providing the care. That's a really difficult social, financial and legal issue. But it's now the current trend because families see it as the best way to provide the care with the uncertainty about the quality of care in residential aged care and the paucity of home care. If you wanted, for example, Philip, to get 24-hour, 7-day-a-week in-home care, it would cost you currently close on $7,000 a week. Now, there aren't too many people who've got a lazy $350,000 a year for the privilege of being able to stay at home, no matter what their circumstances or condition. So the trouble now is, even with a level 4 home care package, which is the highest home care package you can get, it will only give you 10 hours of care a week. And there are 160 hours in a week. what's going to happen with the other 150 hours when someone needs full-time care? This is a major crisis evolving at the moment and putting lots of pressure on families. And again, it's a planning issue. And it's something that really concerns me because a lot of people are entering into these arrangements without considering the implications or indeed, once again, here it goes again, the issue of documenting the arrangements. Mm.
You talk a bit about granny flats in your book. I mean, in general, is the granny flat proposal a good idea, do you think?
Speaking, I think it is. It's a bit like a horse race. What happens is a parent says, I'd like to move in with that child. And the child says, I'd like you to move in with me. And what normally happens is the parent pays a large sum of money sometimes to that child for the privilege of moving in with that child or building a granny flat. And the child reciprocates by saying, I'll care for you for the rest of your life. Now, what can happen, of course, if mum dies the next day, that child is way ahead. Because if mum has paid her $300,000, then that child has received $300,000 for one day of care for her mum. Alternatively, the mum could live for another 25 years and then the mum wins and the daughter potentially loses. So it's got all sorts of contingencies about it, but it's the best way of providing care because both parties usually are well motivated. In other words, they want this to work and even the other siblings want it to work. But it comes with all sorts of hairs. For example, mum would normally be required to look at her will and change it in deference to the fact she's given a large sum of money to one of the children during her life. So it comes with those implications that need to be addressed, and those oral arrangements where these issues are not addressed can fall over really quickly in family calamity and become catastrophic consequences, particularly for mum. I've had examples where that's been the case, where mum has been standing out on the street, having been evicted by her daughter, or more particularly, the son-in-law, 3 months after she moved into the granny flat arrangement, and the daughter refused to give back any of the money that the mum paid to her. Mm-hmm. So she was literally homeless because of the breakdown of the relationship, because it was never documented.
What would have been a way for her to protect herself in an instance like that? I mean, is it possible to come to a written agreement about that?
Of course it is. The agreement would say, I pay you $300,000 in exchange for the right to live in your house or in the granny flat for the rest of my life. If, however, I cannot live there anymore and I have to go and live somewhere else, you will pay to me or back to me that sum of money, or indeed, a really good agreement might say, you will pay back to me what that sum of money represents as a proportion of the increased value of your property as a result of my contribution. So mum gets an equitable share of the value of the property over and above what the contribution was. She then has this money to use to find alternative accommodation or to go into residential aged care, for example. So that sort of arrangement is never something that's orally agreed on. People don't even consider that. They never consider the exit plan. All they think about is the entry plan. And the exit plan is where it all falls down. And that's why documenting it can be so important because it forms the exit plan a large part of the document. What are the contingencies? What's going to happen in these what-if situations?
Yeah. Okay, I'm talking with Brian Hurd. He's a lawyer working in the field of elder law and has written a book, most interesting and information-filled book called The Aging Parent Trap, Essential Information and Solutions for those considering the future care of aging parents. Sharon from Mount Hawthorne. Hello, Sharon.
Oh, hello. My mother-in-law has just gone into aged care and we do need some financial advice. I was just wondering, do all financial advisors know about aged care or do you have to have a specific financial advisor that knows about that?
Sharon, the answer to your question is no, not all financial advisors know about aged care. There are some who are experts in providing financial advice. The number is increasing because they are starting to realise the importance of providing this sort of advice. The need for it is increasing. So there are some financial advisors who are specialists in providing aged care advice. I don't know where you are, but certainly, if you contact the Financial Services Association, I think it's called, they can probably refer you to an appropriate specialised financial advisor. Very important you do that. because they can give you the financial landscape and the picture and give you advice as to what you should do in terms of paying for the residential aged care for your mother-in-law.
So contact financial services advice, is it?
I think it's called the Financial Planning Association or something like that. It's a peak body for financial advisors.
Okay. Financial Planning Advisors. Okay.
Association. Yeah.
Association. All right. Mm.
Thanks, Sharon. Thanks, Sharon. Good on you. Good luck with it too. 1-300-800-222. My number is, if you'd like to talk, call. We're talking with Brian Hurd, a lawyer working in the field of elder law. Yes, Ted from Caboolture has texted me saying, Phil, these three things you need when you circumstances change. You need a will. You need an enduring power of attorney, which we've talked about. You also need an advanced health care directive. And I think you'd agree with that too, Brian, that that's an important document, isn't it?
It's a very important document, the advanced health directive, because it gives you the ability to put in writing the sort of health care you would or wouldn't want if you should ever lose your capacity to make your own health care decisions, including whether you do or you don't want life-sustaining measures. I've done one because I don't want my children circling my wagon when I'm in hospital. And they're asked the question, do you want to keep him on or off? And the children can't agree. Now, you can't imagine a more serious decision that you leave with your children than to turn dad on or off. But if I'd done an advance health directive, there it is in black and white. Children, this is what I want or don't want if ever you are in this situation. Why wouldn't you do one? Because again, it's a legacy issue. The legacy of not doing one is family disagreement, family implosion, family dysfunction, etc. So the ability to do one is really part of this family planning process, planning for the eventuality that this could happen. It may not happen, but it could happen. And don't you want to leave a legacy where your children or your spouse or your family generally know what you want when you can't tell them what you want? It's pretty simple, really.
Yes, indeed. All right. One of my texters says, if I lent the refundable accommodation deposit to a parent, is that amount so lent then treated as part of the parent's assets for Centrelink? Well, I think it is, but it's an exempt asset, isn't it, Brian?
Well, it'll be a liability. So when Centrelink assesses your, when they do their assets test, they assess your assets and your liabilities. So if you owe money to someone, such as in that situation, that money you owe, that loan that you have to repay, is a debt, is a liability. So that will be taken into account. And that's why it's important to document it, because if you don't document it, Centrelink won't believe it. Centrelink might think it's a gift. So unless you've got it documented, you can't characterise the nature of the advance. And Centrelink want to know, what is the nature of that sum of money that you gave to that person? Because most people like to have a handshake, have a nod, have a wink, and not realising that Centrelink want to know what is the character of that transaction, because they need to know in order to assess your assets test properly. Documented.
Documented at all times, exactly. Robin from Tagulawa in the Brisbane Valley in southeast Queensland says, Phil and Brian, I'm single in my 60s, no kids, I'm renting, I've got no money, but I have a lot of furniture and possessions. I don't have a will. I have my father, two sisters and one brother. What would happen to my estate?
In other words, shared between your father and your sisters.
Just start that again, Brian. We missed the start of that. Sorry.
It would be shared between your father and your sister, sisters.
And the brother.
Even so, I'd still recommend you do a will. It'd be pretty simple, but I think you should do one. Just in case, for example, and this is the trouble with people giving things in their will, is that if you say, I give all my things to four people, the question is, which of those four people get which thing? Because the things are worth different values, probably. So it's much better in your circumstances, even though you don't have a lot of assets or an estate of significance, is to be able to sit down and say which of those things you want to give to which person. So there's no doubt about what you want to go to whom, and the issue of value is not relevant, because it's simply you saying, what thing do you want to go to what person, as opposed to you saying to the four of them, you work it out, because they invariably can't work it out. because there's a financial value to things, there's a sentimental value to things. You wouldn't believe the amount of disputes I've dealt with over war medals, for example. It's incredible how war medals create all sorts of disputes within families.
I wouldn't be in the least surprised, Brian. I'm sure they're often very trivial objects, but which have immense sentimental value, which can cause all sorts of palaver in families.
Huge sentimental value. And it's almost impossible to cut them up or divide them up. Mm. So it becomes very difficult to resolve. Mm. Unless you give them specifically to somebody.
Mm. Yes. If you decide you want to become your parents' carer, what are the sort of things you need to consider?
The disruption to your life, the need for respite, the deprivation of your previous life in terms of the pleasures you may have had in previous life, the 24-hour dependency of your parents. You will be on watch for 24 hours. You, generally speaking, should not be their enduring power of attorney. In other words, it's not a good idea for parents to appoint a child who ends up caring for them as the enduring power of attorney.
Why?
Because that means you expose that child to control over the parents' affairs in a situation where they are with the parents, totally in control of their affairs, are managing their finances, because it's convenient, see? It's inconvenient to appoint another child outside the family to manage those finances while one child is actually inside caring for the parents. It's just more convenient for that carer to go to the bank, take out some money, as opposed to the child who's not living there to have to organise it. So it's efficient. But it leads to potential conflicts of interest. It can lead to temptations to abuse the power. And the reality is, it sounds like a logical thing to do. If I care for you, let me make decisions for you. But in reality, it's a temptation to do the wrong thing. And also raises suspicions in the outside family as to what are they up to. Because there's this tight little world that's created between the parents and the carer who all live together, and there's no requirement in the law for an attorney, an enduring attorney, to be transparent or to provide accounts to anybody. It's a very private arrangement. The whole area of decision-making for parents has been privatised in the last 20 years. Before that, we had benevolent bureaucrats making these decisions for people who lost their capacity. But in the last 20 years, all these laws have been passed, privatising the ability of parents to appoint their family members to make these decisions, which is a great thing, but has exposed the potential for abuse, particularly financial abuse, that needs to be very carefully watched. Mm.
Sharon, hello.
Hello.
Hi, Sharon.
Hi. Sorry, I'm a little bit upset. Because I've been thinking about, I'm in a situation where we found out that our parent was the subject of financial abuse from a sibling. Mm-hmm. And we two siblings have also found out that we've been, we're the subject of financial abuse. For example, that other sibling has got my life savings. Mm-hmm. And I've got proof of all of that. And they've stolen so many things from us and from the family, what my parent left. And it's been financially devastating and extremely stressful. And I was getting quite excited before because, Brian, I thought you were exactly the solicitor we need, but unfortunately I think you're in Brisbane, aren't you?
Brisbane, yes.
Mm. Yeah, and I'm down the other end of Australia.
Right.
Yeah, because we've got a situation where the sibling is mentally ill and married to a narcissist, and they've been thieving for us for a generation now. And they were trying to get me to sign over every, my will to will everything to them and their children. And their children were stealing from us as well. And so it's an intractable situation where they're lying through their teeth. Mm. And they're very greedy.
You need some proper legal advice, don't you?
I do.
Brian, doesn't Sharon?
Cries out for it, Sharon. So I don't know which state or territory you're in, but you need to get some legal advice pronto. Because what you're talking about needs pronto legal advice and potentially pronto legal action.
Yes, exactly.
Like fast.
Yes, exactly. All right. Good luck, Sharon. But that's absolutely right. You do need some immediate legal action. My texter says it's been mentioned we should document everything. Does that mean only by a solicitor?
No, it doesn't. There's no law which requires a solicitor to document things in relation to family arrangements. But guess what? predictably, I'd have to say, you're silly if you don't use a solicitor to do it.
Hmm.
Because the reality is solicitors have the skill and experience, for example, someone like me, to know what to put in the document. If you start with a blank piece of paper and think, what am I going to put in this agreement? That can be very arduous. And no doubt, in many cases, you will miss things that you should have addressed. So the ability of a lawyer is to tell you what issues need to be addressed to make that document a good document, as opposed to a document that you do yourself, which you're happy with, but may be able to run a D9 dozer through because it's not comprehensive or complete.
Hmm.
So it's a quality issue. You know, I think I said something before about we concentrate as Australians on the price of doing something as opposed to the cost of doing nothing. And the cost of doing nothing is always going to exceed the price of doing something.
All right. Your book is called The Avoiding the Aging Parent Trap. It's full of terrific information that's available now. And if you're preparing, I would recommend that you have a read of it. Brian, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Philip, very much so.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.